Would you love to attend an American college or graduate program and aren't sure how to make it happen because you are not a U.S. citizen or permanent resident? Listen in. We have an expert on international admissions on the show who can guide you. Welcome to the 274th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, except it's a podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm accepted!" Not only accepted, but accepted at the best program for you. Now, this podcast is sponsored by Fitting In and Standing Out, the paradox at the heart of admissions. Accepted's guides to help you handle that paradox with authenticity and skill. Grab your free copy at accepted.com/FISO for Fitting In, Standing Out. Again, that's accepted.com/FISO. Our guest today is Dr. Jeff Davis. Since earning his PhD in international higher education from Boston College, Dr. Davis has spent nearly 30 years in international student program management and admissions. He has taught or served in administration at leading universities, including Clark University, Drexel University, Kent State, SUNY Stony Brook, Youngstown State, and Wharton. He has traveled to over 30 countries around the world. He is the author of Intercultural Sensitivity in Foreign Student Advising and the co-author of the 6th edition of Living in the USA. I am also happy to announce that Dr. Davis has joined Accepted and is available to guide you to acceptance to U.S. graduate programs. Let's find out from Dr. Davis what international students to U.S. graduate programs need to know as they approach the application gauntlet on the graduate level. Dr. Davis, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you. Now, let's start with the beginning. How did you get interested in international admissions?
Well, I began working with international students when I was still an undergraduate. And like many Americans, I had a very limited knowledge of worldviews outside of not only the country, but my own region. And I found international students just a wealth of information about the larger world, and they challenged me to think differently about my own assumptions and values. So I got very interested in working with them and went on to pursue a master's in higher education, working with and supporting international students in the U.S.
And then you went also pursued the PhD?
And then, yes, I actually did the PhD much later, after working for about 15 years in the field. Went back through the admissions gauntlet to be a full-time graduate student and worked in larger international programs areas in a more broadly than international students since.
Okay. What do you think is the hardest part of the U.S. admissions process for international applicants? And here I'm talking very broadly.
Well, I think that all the challenges that U.S. students face in applying to colleges, universities, and graduate and professional programs are the same ones that international students face with, but the international students, by and large, experience them at a greatly magnified level. So just trying to understand what it is they're looking for when there are questions on the application, understanding why are they asking me this and what is the appropriate response. The cultural factors really play into it in terms of writing a statement of purpose or a graduate application essay, where really a certain level of confidence and, you know, self-conviction are called for. And the way that Americans typically might answer those might strike international students from many different countries as bragging or, you know, lack of humility in general. And so being able to really express your best assets and why your strengths would be a good fit for the program sometimes gets lost in, you know, more humble language.
Right. I recently interviewed Dr. Rob Garris, who's the director of admissions at the Schwartzman Scholars Program.
Mm-hmm.
Schwartzman's Scholars Program has a very defined that they want, I think it was initially they wanted 40% Americans, 40% Chinese, and 20% the rest of the world, or some, maybe the ratio is slightly off, but the 40% Americans was, I think, how they defined this particular program. And they changed they reduced the number of Americans. It might have been that it was 50 and then it moved to 45, but they reduced the number of Americans in the program because they found that Americans tended to dominate. They talked a lot more and they dominated. Right. So they reduced the percentage of Americans. That's, by the way, if anybody's interested, episode 267, exhibit.com/267. But it was an interesting reflection on, I guess, just some cultural differences. Probably also led to the stereotype of the ugly American that was, you know, prevalent post-World War II.
Certainly.
Yeah. What is the hardest element for international students to adjust to once they get here? So there are more and more international students. You've run the programs, so.
Yes. The number one thing we tend to hear is food.
Okay.
The American diet is quite different from the standard diet in most parts of the world, especially its heavy emphasis on meat and more heavy foods. And so students from East Asia in particular have a real challenge finding food that is satisfying for them. The other thing is related to what we were just talking about, that it's very difficult for them to participate in classroom discussions. For the reason that many Americans will just jump in without even having thought through what they want to say, but also the fact that the American classroom discussion is so atypical in world education systems. So,
in what
sense? Students have never been asked to answer a question in a classroom before. It's a one-way delivery in many parts of the world. So, mm-hmm. They're quite used to taking notes and listening to what the teacher says and then spitting that back out on an exam, but not so experienced with trying to synthesize the information and develop their own point of view on what the information might mean or how it can be applied. So practical applications are challenging. Many things about the U.S. classroom just are very, very different. And not to mention that for most of them, they're working in a language that isn't their own. So they've never had to. They might be able to speak and read and write English within the context of an English class, but to then apply that into a class in political geography or engineering or any of the sciences, that's a very new experience. So often students will have the vocabulary, general English vocabulary, but not the field-specific vocabulary. And so those challenges really can add up for students.
Do you see, we've talked obviously in very, very broad terms about some differences in international education, but what about some regional differences in terms of application difficulty from students, let's say, from China, which is sending enormous numbers of students to the U.S. Mm-hmm. in recent years?
Yes.
Specifically for Chinese students, what are some of the difficulties they encounter in the application process now?
Well, the writing parts of an application in very competitive programs require that kind of bragging and self-reflection. And so students from China usually have had very limited experience with writing an essay in English and having it critiqued and, having to develop an understanding of improving the way that they're expressing themselves. Their English language education is focused largely on grammatical rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have usually decent vocabulary and good, if not excellent, grammar, but the writing part can be a challenge. Students from the Middle East, for example, have an education in English that really focuses on oral proficiency.
Really?
Yeah, so it's very common to have students from places like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait who can speak practically like a native, but have enormous difficulties with writing because they've never really had to be pushed in developing writing. And then, of course, mathematical education usually is much better in many parts of the world, in that more students are pushed to higher levels of math concepts. And so those parts of, say, a standardized exam will often go very well for students, but then really struggle with the language-related portions.
What are some of the challenges facing applicants from India as a rule?
Well, right now, the biggest challenge for Indian applicants is the visa gauntlet. I think the U.S. experienced around a 20% decline in Indian students or new Indian students between 2016 and 2017.
Mm-hmm. Because of visa restrictions?
Because of the vast difficulties students were encountering obtaining visas. And just the increased timeline, you know, the lag time it takes between initiating an application for a visa and ultimately receiving approval, and just flat out denials. Indian students, because they tend to, especially at the graduate level, they've all done an undergraduate degree with a great deal of it taking place in English. So for Indian students, language tends to be much less of a difficulty. Certainly Indian English has some marked differences from what most U.S. Students will speak and understand, but those can be overcome. But there are those educational differences, again, where they've never been asked to synthesize, they've never been asked to develop practical applications or put together an argument for their point of view, which is common in almost all fields in the U.S.
Right. I also find that sometimes Indian applicants have a lot of difficulty with word limits.
Yes.
Chinese applicants, I think, have more difficulty filling up the word limits. And
right.
So we've discussed some difficulties, right? One is just this reliance on synthesis or critical thinking. Another one is requirement to be a little bit more self-aware and expressive of that self-awareness. It's not just being self-aware, it's being able to express it. Do you have any suggestions or exercises, if you will, or things that applicants in different parts of the world can do other than being aware of the differences to kind of prepare themselves to address these differences in the application process?
Well, on the essay completion parts, mm-hmm. I think certainly being able to find someone who is a native speaker to read and give feedback on draft after draft. And that's true for everyone. Our first draft is never our best work.
I always say that writers have editors for a reason. Professional.
Yes, exactly. And so the real challenge for many students is to understand what it is these institutions are looking for. You know that many competitive programs could fill their entire capacity with students with nearly perfect scores on the standardized exam and nearly perfect grades.
Great.
And they're selecting among students with very high academic records or very strong academic records based on this very nebulous idea of fit, mm-hmm. and who's going to succeed there, who's going to both shine as a student in their program and be a credit to the program later, and how does one communicate that when they haven't really explicitly asked that, you know, that's a real challenge for students.
I actually did a whole show. I'm going to try it. We'll link to it on fit, demonstrating fit. So yeah, focus on fit, and I'll link to it from the show notes also. I think it was 176, but I'll double check that.
The other big challenge, I think, is that although there's information available, sometimes too much information available, so much so that it's overwhelming, but finding the kind of information that would help prospective students select those programs for which they would be the best fit is a huge challenge. I mean, so people tend to work from a limited list of institutions they've heard of, either because of ranking systems or because they happen to know of someone who went there. And there are countless other programs for which they might be a better fit, both academic profile and be more comfortable. So Chinese students will tend to apply to U.S. institutions that have many, many Chinese students. That may not be their best fit, and it may not be the best, you know, way to stand out as an applicant.
Right. There's a focus on the brand name schools. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the brand name schools have got that brand usually for a good reason. But what might be overall outstanding brand might not be outstanding in a specific niche.
Right, right.
Which is particularly important for graduate studies.
Right. But when you look at the top ranked institutions, to say that there is some meaningful difference between number 23 and number 31 is, I think, at times a stretch, that there may be differences, but those differences are lost in the pluses of the lower ranked programs, which you can't identify from a simple ranking.
Right. Well, I actually recently interviewed Bob Morse of US News,
yes,
the head of rankings. And mm-hmm. one of the things he said is that the differences, the educationally qualitative differences among schools that are have a small difference in terms of rankings are nebulous.
They're absolutely
insignificant. Yeah. But if you look at school that's ranked 8th versus 80th, there you
right.
probably are going to see something significant, both in terms of student right. quality, teacher quality, et cetera. So anyway, that was I'll link to that show also.
Yes.
That was just a few weeks ago. Now, we've covered China, India, and Middle East and Africa. What about Europe? And what about our friends to the south in Central and South America? Again, I'm talking now in terms of challenges in the application process.
Right. European students, particularly Western European students in general, because their numbers are relatively low in U.S. institutions,
right.
they tend to do pretty well with the application process. I think they tend to get the cultural distinctions more readily. Europe is, by and large, a very multicultural place
right.
with a lot of U.S. influence, and there's quite a bit of information available for students. Their English language education tends to be very high and very applicable to U.S. higher education. So I don't really see any particular challenges that are unique to students from Europe. South and Central America, again, there's this tendency to apply to institutions where those students are in large numbers. And I think that can be quite detrimental to their chances at a really strong program. There are so many schools that have trouble attracting them because of weather, because of history.
Mm-hmm.
And those students really could benefit by branching out to different parts of the U.S. than those that, in the South and in the West part of the U.S. where students from Latin America tend to go.
Right. Now, what about adjustment to the United States? What suggestions would you have? Let's say, and let's look at it regionally, for people coming from China or coming from India, Europe, mm-hmm. the other regions that we've discussed, what are the most significant differences and how can, other than just acknowledging that these differences are going to happen and being aware of them, deal with them once they get here? Let's start again with China.
Sure. Well, the big challenge for students from most countries is to break out of the social world of their co-nationals. So Chinese students, it's very hard when you're a student, one of 500 Chinese students on a campus of 30,000 to find your way into the social world outside of the Chinese student community. But that is exactly what it takes to really thrive, to be able to work through the discomfort of getting to know a new culture, not just on a surface level, but on a deep level, and to be able to function in it. So that's true not just for Chinese students, although I do think it's harder for many students from China to make that break because of the way that English has been taught and the challenges they have in making social small talk in English.
I also remember I did a year abroad program when I was in school, and I don't know if this is true of American students, but and I had a wonderful time and I really enjoyed it. But there is a tendency for students to kind of, and for people wherever they are, to stick with their own group.
Absolutely. And, you know, I thank you for pointing that out, because I don't ever mean for this to sound like this is a Chinese problem or an Indian problem, because no one sticks together in a foreign country like Americans.
Well, I wasn't even going to say that. I mean, the host country, in this case, the United States, in my case, they also tended to stick together.
Well, right. The majority, the larger group. Somehow expects a minority, whatever minority it is, to penetrate their social world, and doesn't often, especially in the United States, feel the obligation to reach out. The U.S. doesn't have a tradition of the depth of hospitality that you find in a place like Latin America or India. You know, if you're a traveler in one of those countries, you will be approached and invited and included in a way that is not so common in the U.S., especially in the large U.S. American cities where foreign travelers are, you know, quite common.
Right.
You know, if you go to a regional state university or an institution that's in a small town or a smaller city, you're much more likely to be included in all kinds of social things. And you might think, well, I'm not here for social things, but really the social aspect is what is going to make the difference in how well you thrive academically.
Right. Okay. One of the other things I remember from my year abroad, which wasn't Israel, was that at the time, I think it has changed in Israel since then, because this was a long time ago, but it was like the whole culture of going out, meeting people at a restaurant or a cafe was much less common. You invited people to your home.
Mm-hmm.
And in the United States, it's much more common. Unless you really are very good friends, let's go out to dinner, right? Let's go meet at a coffee shop or, you know, Starbucks, whatever. And only when you have a much closer relationship, you ask, do you want to come to my house? That was very different in Israel. When I was there. Again, I think it's changed. I think it's become a little bit more like the U.S. in that regard. But mm-hmm. I would assume that in some other parts of the world, that's very true too.
Absolutely. I lived in Azerbaijan for a while. And after independence, there were only two functioning restaurants in the capital.
Wow.
People, you know, you could drive to the countryside and they would prepare a meal for you. You pull up to a roadside stand and they would pick the goat out and make it ready. But you didn't have any place really to go and gather other than people's homes. And that's what everyone did.
Right. Now, any other regional differences in terms of difficulty adjusting to the U.S. once they get here? Let's say, again, either South America, South and Central America, Europe, Middle East.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of that question.
Yeah, I think the audio cut out for a second there.
Yes.
Any regional differences, additional regional differences in terms of adjustment to life in the United States, specific to particular regions? And here, let's look at South Central America, the Middle East, Europe. I think we talked about China.
Right. And I think that's also largely dependent on which part of the United States the student's in.
Okay.
I think that if you're from, you know, Brazil, or if you're from Colombia and you're in Miami or L.A., it's a different set of challenges than if you're in Dubuque, Iowa.
Well, there you'll have in the big cities, you'll have probably a big community of people from
right.
your home country.
Right. And if not from your country, from your region, a group who speak your native language. And even when you're very fluent in a second language, it's tiring to function in it.
That's right.
All the time.
So. Yes.
And so, you know, that's true for students from China. When they're in a place with a large Chinese community, they can find the food that they prefer. They can find, you know, media to consume that's in their native language. And so those challenges are more easily dealt with. Whereas if you're from a country, let's say Bangladesh or Nepal, where it's you're not likely to find a large community of co-nationals. Those challenges, you know, are greatly exaggerated.
Okay. What kind of research or preparation do you recommend international applicants do before deciding to come to the U.S. and before applying?
One of the things that I think it would be critical that is not readily available is what is the retention rate of international students in particular institutions.
And it's very easy to find. How can you find that?
You would have to contact institutions and really, you know, ask the hard questions about how good a job do they do in supporting and serving the international student population. You know, when we talk about international students in such a broad stroke,
but right.
Of course, there are more cultural differences in the international student group than there is in the rest of the campus population put together. But finding out what support services are available specifically to meet the needs of international students. What's the level of writing center support? What's the level of international student advising support? You know, is the International Student Services area primarily an immigration shop that deals with the paperwork and, you know, is too overwhelmed to do much in the way of programming? Or are there activities, not that they can just feel free to join, everyone can join the activities, but that are designed to help them make the transition, that really allow them to become part of the community? Host family programs, outreach, you know, mixers between international students and U.S. students, those kinds of activities.
Like, okay, so these are the things, what they should be asking. What would you like to see, let's say, to provide a welcoming, hospitable environment on a college campus for international students?
One of the things that we developed at Youngstown State University was a weekly program that all international students were invited to and was hosted each week by different community organizations, so outside the university.
Mm-hmm.
And their charge was to provide refreshments and to bring at least 5 members. So they would bring, you know, it would be like a women's scholarship committee or church group or Rotary,
mm-hmm.
Those kinds of organizations. And they would bring, you know, at least 5, usually quite a few more of their members to just socialize with international students. And what grows from that is frequent invitations to family picnics, to sporting events, to outings. You don't really begin to feel comfortable in a country until you've spent a good deal of time in a private home.
And
if you're an international student, you spend all of your world on campus, you don't really have that opportunity. So getting, you know, those kinds of programs that get international students familiar with the family, with the community, with the fabric of the outside of the institution. Institutions that offer that are much more likely to take the success of international students as a very high priority.
Okay. And what about, you mentioned the writing center and academic support. What should the international applicant be looking for in terms of that kind of support on a campus that they're considering?
The Writing Center should have ESL specialists who will go beyond providing sort of writing advice, but actually, you know, coaching. The math support services should be extensive, which I think most campuses do nowadays. Mm-hmm. And the advising and tutorial services should be really directed at meeting the needs of all students. You know, the tutoring center shouldn't be perceived as a place where only students who are struggling go, but where all students go to do their best.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find that kind of information in the university's services description, but how they're described can really give you, you know, insight into how extensive they are and how seriously they take their outreach mission.
What would be some key phrases or words or that would say this center is really doing a good job, or this one is kind of mediocre?
Well, I think just very basic language saying, yes, we offer tutoring services, They're here. Mm-hmm. If you need us, contact us, versus a description that says we're offering tutoring in all subjects and students are encouraged to meet on a regular basis with a peer advisor to go over their goals and their academic, you know, struggles and programs that really develop the student's maximum success. The other area is career services. Mm-hmm. Really look for career services that take job search needs of international students seriously. And you look for places that do outreach and internships outside the U.S. as well as work with U.S. companies.
Okay. Do you see any, now we've talked about some regional differences, but do you see any distinctions for international applicants in terms of the way they're viewed or the process, if let's say they're applying to engineering programs versus MBA programs or perhaps some other specialties, you know, life sciences, whatever?
Yes, I think the big sort of question in the minds of people reviewing applications from international students to, say, an MBA program, mm-hmm. It's often pretty quickly apparent that they can do the necessary quantitative work and that they can do the sort of heavy lifting, you know, academic work. But the question is how well they can integrate into groups for group projects. Mm-hmm. And so being able to articulate, you know, the applicant's ability that of working with others and working under challenges and succeeding with challenges, those things are, I think, really, you know, central to standing out for an MBA program. Engineering programs tend to really look quantitatively. And, mm-hmm. You know, the fact is that many science and engineering programs are staffed with faculty who came to the U.S. originally as international students. And so that's much less of a concern in those programs.
Right. One of the things that I always think distinguishes, you know, international admissions and applicants is that in many, many countries around the world, there is such a focus on, as a criteria for admission, it's a test and the grade, the numbers, stats mm-hmm. only. And so they, you know, if they have good grades and they ace the GMAT, GRE, whatever test score is relevant, then they feel like, well, then I'm in.
And then I should be in.
Right? I should be in, right. And then, and you know, who cares about the statement of purpose or personal statement or application essays or what does other stuff matter? But of course, it matters a lot. And I would guess that it matters more in MBA programs than in, let's say, engineering programs. Am I correct?
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Also matters extensively at undergraduate.
Right. Right.
Selective undergraduate institutions.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, I was the podcast as a rule focuses exclusively on graduate admissions, so I wasn't going to I know that you are expert in undergraduate admissions as well as the graduate international admissions scene. But can you just touch for a moment on perhaps something that undergrads, the younger siblings and cousins of perhaps listeners to this mm-hmm. podcast should think about if they're thinking of attending a U.S. college undergraduate program from abroad?
Sure. The main thing, again, is fit. You know, it's finding a place where you really are going to feel part of the student community, that you're going to feel valued by the faculty, that your presence in the international perspective that you're bringing is something that is not just tolerated but really embraced. The selection of the institution can be, you know, really, really important for undergraduate applicants as well. And then just getting in, it's all of the co-curricular involvement. You know, right. Okay, we see you studied well. I see you aced the SAT. What else did you do? And that kind of question could be really surprising.
I have to do something else. I have to do something else.
Yeah. What do you want to do with your life? How is this degree going to, you know, further you? What are you excited about? What intellectual challenges do you want to tackle? Those kinds of things are really key to making an international applicant stand out.
Right. Now let's return to the graduate. You touched mm-hmm. on career support for international applicants who want to return to their home countries. If they do want to return to their home countries after completing their studies, what can they do to ease their return in terms of finding a job or when they finish their studies?
Well, the number one thing would be to take advantage of some of the downtime between the academic terms to be at home. If there's an internship opportunity, make sure it's either in your home country or with a company, maybe a company that's based in your country or a U.S. company that does a great deal of business with your country.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the top three strategies, I think, for, you know, easing that transition to going home afterward.
All right. And we've had a pretty comprehensive interview covering, you know, before, during, and after international studies in the United States. But what we haven't touched on is the current environment mm-hmm. in the United States. You know, increasing difficulty perhaps getting a visa, the perception that the United States is not as welcoming as it used to be. Can you address that?
Certainly. The perception that the U.S. isn't as welcoming as it used to be is, in the words of, I can't think of who says this, but it's fake news. There are reports that would suggest that the U.S. is less welcoming, but there's really not a lot of meat to it. The U.S., has always been welcoming to international students. And the fact that the institutions which have been enjoying growth in the international student population for better than a decade are now seeing a decline, I think makes this a really good time for international applicants. I think some institutions may have become a little complacent that their international student populations were going to maintain or continue growing. And right now, I think quite a few of them are concerned that there might be a drop in that part of the population. So it's a really great time to apply.
Right. After 9/11, before 9/11, we had a client sign up from the Middle East, and he was applying to elite MBA programs. And after 9/11, about 2 or 3 weeks later, he emailed that he's really having second thoughts about going forward with it because of the anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States that he'd read about. And we encouraged him to apply. We said, unless I think I wrote him, unless he's a supporter of the terrorists who carried out the 9/11 bombings, I said, I don't think you're really going to have a problem at all. And to the contrary, because there will be a drop in international and specifically Middle Eastern applicants, it's a great time to apply.
Mm-hmm.
And he had misgivings, but he went forward and he got into his dream school.
Great.
And he was incredibly appreciative. I think this, and he actually recently referred a relative also to us again, who's applying now to American schools. But the point here is the drop in international applications, which is taking place. It was just an article I read yesterday about a drop in international enrollment at MBA programs, at the top MBA programs, top 25, let's say, it spells opportunity for those still willing to pursue their dreams in the United States.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing is that these political climates come and go, and they tend to cycle through rather quickly. So by the time a student who's looking now to apply to an institution in the U.S. actually arrives, it will likely be a very different climate politically.
Well,
that being said, the travel ban is in effect for students.
Right. Travel ban is in effect. And if somebody applies this application cycle, they'll arrive in 2019, you know, there's not going to be a lot of change by then. Maybe, you know, 2020, 2021,
right,
know, time
right,
will tell.
Right.
Well, you really don't know.
By the time people graduate, I think.
Right. I also don't think, I don't think there's been a big cultural change in terms of attitudes towards international students, you know,
right,
between now and last year on campus. There is a difference in immigration rules. That's very real.
Right, and how vigorously
they're being enforced.
Some absolutely. People are being, yeah, right, and exercising discretion, something that, you know, used to have, be able to expect a certain amount of discretion that worked in the applicant's favor, which I don't think now we can take for granted.
No, I agree. But again, I think for those people who can't get the visa and apply, or who are willing to put up with the visa hassles, I think there's more opportunity for acceptance just because of the numbers.
Yep, that's exactly my interpretation of the current environment.
Right. Well, I think we're running out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining me for this podcast, number 274. And I want to thank you for sharing your experience, your expertise, your perspective on international admissions to U.S. graduate programs. Listeners, if you'd like to work with Dr. Davis on your graduate school applications, I'll link from the show notes at accept.com/274 to both his Contact Me page and our service descriptions, as well as to other related resources and previous podcast episodes, including the Focus on Fit one, the Schwartzman Scholars one, and a couple others that we've mentioned, and the U.S. News one. I want to thank you too, listener, for tuning in to this, our 274th episode. If you found this show worthwhile, please make sure you don't miss any others. Subscribe through your favorite podcatcher. We have subscribe links in the show notes at accept.com/274. Last but not least, I also want to thank our sponsor for today, Fit In and Stand Out, The Paradox at the Heart of Admissions, Accepted's guide to helping you handle that paradox with aplomb. Download your free copy at accept.com/FISO. Again, that's accept.com/FISO. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week. Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.